So first of all, I had a Hilbert space of states, and that was Z2 graded, so it had an odd and an even part. And I had an associative algebra of operators, linear operators acting on the Hilbert space that I called A. And an important part is within that there was this supersymmetry algebra generated by a pair of odd operators Q and its adjoint, Q dagger. And so for today, I'm going to assume a couple of things that I mentioned last time. So in particular, there exists a fermion number that's a symmetry of the theory. What that means is that the Hilbert space and the space of operators will actually be Z-graded. And I'm also going to assume that there's an orthogonal decomposition of the Hilbert space. So I'm going to take that as an assumption today. I tried to describe last time what I thought was the physical intuition going into that decomposition, but for today I'm just going to describe, I'm going to assume that. And today what I want to talk about is in some sense to throw out some of this structure. So I want to throw out the idea that I actually have a Hilbert space rather than say just a vector space. And I want to focus on just one of my supercharges, Q, and try to explain to you the algebraic or the algebraic structures associated to that single supercharge. So I think those algebraic structures are things that are fairly perhaps familiar, but I hope at the very least by explaining like how they arise from this physical setup, then that will help to give you some way to discuss these things perhaps with physicists. Okay, so I want to begin then by talking about operators again. So first things first, I said that I'm going to assume that I have a fermion number symmetry. So that fermion number symmetry was generated by some self-adjoint operator F. And in particular, what it means is that my algebra of operators is going to be Z-graded. So the operators have a charge. So I can decompose my algebra of operators like this, where say AJ is given by those operators A that satisfy the following equation. That if I take their commutator with F, then that measures the charge of the operator. Certainly true in the examples that I'm going to consider. Could somebody help me out? Sorry? Yes. I think that's an example, indeed. Yeah, so a supersymmetric harmonic oscillator, I guess, is... There's always a Z2, yes, but it may not be enhanced to a Z. Yeah. Okay, well, in particular, the supercharge Q has degree 1. And so it acts as a differential. Yeah. Okay, thanks. Did everybody hear that? So Tudor was suggesting later on if you do an equivariant version of this, which is like a gauge version of quantum mechanics, then this is another example. Okay, so the supercharge has degree one, and so it acts as a differential. And the differential is essentially by taking commutators with Q. Perhaps now is a good time to mention that from here on, you remember in the last talk I was using both curly brackets for anticommutators and brackets for commutators. So let me try to use a uniform notation in this lecture, where A bracket B means AB minus this thing. Except somehow I can't bring myself to write this in the SUSY algebra because it's always with curly brackets. Okay, and finally, the differential is compatible with the product. That's just the fact that the commutator is a derivation. So in particular, if I take the commutator of Q with AB, then I get A. Commutator of Q with A times B plus A times the commutator of Q with B. And so putting all this data together, what does it mean? Well, it means that the algebra of operators is a DG algebra. So that's the first bit of structure. That's the structure that the supercharge Q endows the algebra of operators. Okay, so much for operators. Let me now discuss states. Okay, so 2.2 is states revisited. And likewise, we have a fermion number, so just like last time, the Hilbert space of space has a decomposition, like this. And again, just like before, the operator Q provides a differential. So if I draw a picture of the Hilbert space, then it looks something like this. This was a picture that I drew last time together with Q dagger and H, but now I've just removed Q dagger and H from the picture. And furthermore, the differentials on the algebra of operators and on the states are compatible. And so what this is going to mean is that the space of states is a DG module. So what do I mean by compatible? I mean, if I first act with some operator A on a state, psi, and then I act with Q, well, a trivial thing tells me that that's given by the commutator of Q with A acting on the state, and then I need to subtract off the piece that I added. What does that mean? Well, it means that the states form a DG module for the DG algebra of operators. So this is the structure, I think, that the supercharged Q endows the spaces of states and operators. And so let me emphasize one thing, that this structure is coming, at least for me, this structure is coming entirely from supersymmetry. So Q is a supercharge. Okay, so what I'm going to be interested in for the most part of the lecture is actually trying to pass to the cohomology of the supercharge and understanding how the structures that we have here are transferred onto structures on the cohomology. That's something that physicists are interested in doing. So in particular, last time we talked about the space of supersymmetric ground states and how these were given by harmonic forms in the examples we gave. Well, in the examples we gave, harmonic forms can also be described as Dolbeau cohomology classes. And so, for example, if we're interested in the space of supersymmetric ground states of lowest energy, then we should be interested, say, in passing to the cohomology of the supercharge and then understanding what structures that inherits. Okay. So again, I'm going to look at operators and states in turn. So let me first look at the case of operators. Okay, so let me make a definition, which is coming from physics, which is we say that a BPS operator is one that commutes with the supercharge Q. I might say that this is in some sense a half BPS operator because it's commuting with half of the supercharges. In this case, just Q. So if I have an operator that obeys this condition, then it will define a cohomology class that I could perhaps write with bracket of A in the cohomology of my DG algebra. And so just maybe to lighten the notation, I will refer to the cohomology as O for operators. So what kind of structure do we get on the space of BPS operators? Well, on general grounds, we have a transfer of structure from the DG structure on the algebra of operators. Then we're going to get something like an A infinity structure on the cohomology. So at the moment, this is something very abstract, but towards the end of my lectures, I'm going to try to give a very explicit examples of this kind of thing. So what happens? Well, the cohomology inherits an A infinity structure. So what do I mean by that? Well, I'm not going to tell you the full definition, but I'm going to give you the pieces. So in particular, there should be some maps, mu n, which go from n copies of O back to O. So you can think about this somehow as a map where I'm trying to bring n operators together somehow in some non-trivial way to define a new operator. So these maps should have degree given by 2 minus n. And because we're obtaining this as the cohomology of some DG algebra, then this is not completely generic. So in particular, the map mu1, which would just be a differential, that vanishes because we're passing to the cohomology of Q. Mu2 is just a product, so mu2 is inherited from the product upstairs. What does that mean in practice? Well, it just means that I define the product of two classes to be pick some representatives and take their product upstairs and then take the class of that. Sorry? Yes, this product is associative. So because the differential vanishes, then it's going to be associative. So so indeed, I haven't written down. There are a variety of relations that should be obeyed by these maps. I'm not going to write them down. But in particular, if the differential vanishes, then those relations will tell you that this product is associative. Yeah, mu3 may not be trivial. Yes. Exactly, and it will be given by a Massey product, yes. And let me say one more thing, which is that this structure is not unique, but it's unique up to quasi-isomorphism. And I'm not going to say exactly what that means, but maybe intuitively I can say, if we just have the structure of the supercharged Q, then we're not going to get a unique infinity structure, but only up to quasi-isomorphism. But I suspect if I also allow myself the data of Q dagger and the Hilbert space structure, then this will fix a unique choice. In the same way that if I just have the Durham differential, I'm studying Durham cohomology classes, but if I'm allowed to use D star, its adjoint, then I can pick a unique harmonic representative. And indeed, as you say, this examples of these higher products are coming from Massey products. And so let me try to explain physically what happens there in terms of BPS operators. Or how a physicist might try to understand what these higher products mean. So suppose we have three BPS operators. Let me call them A1, A2, and A3. So they all commute with Q. And suppose that pairwise, their products vanish in cohomology. What does that mean? It means that if I compose two of my BPS operators, then the result has to be Q of something. So So let me call that something B12. And likewise, if I take the composition of A2 with A3, that should also be Q of something. Let me call it B23. But then given a choice of these B12s and B23s, these may not be unique, then I can form another operator. Let's call it A123, given by B12, A3, minus 1, to the fermion number of A, A1, B23. And then it's fairly clear to see that this operator is also BPS. Basically, because when I take the commutator with Q, I get the cancellation between the two terms. And so in particular, A123 will also define a cohomology class. So we can think about this as a map that's taken three operators and has composed them in a particular way to get another BPS operator. And the higher products, for example, mu3, are of this type. Now in this procedure, there's a lot of ambiguity. It may be that if I choose different representative, yes? Ah, sorry, it's A1, yes. Because here I want the Q to commute past A1 to act on the B23. So the choices of representatives here for B12 and B23 are not unique. There might be many choices. And if I make different choices here, I may actually get different cohomology classes. Defined by A123. So there's no unique Massey product in general, and I think that's to do with this fact here. But nevertheless, this is how these extra structures should arise. Okay, so I want to mention one more important feature of BPS operators, which is how they depend on time. And the answer is they don't, in some sense. So first of all, operators will only depend on time if I'm working in the Heisenberg picture. So let me do that. Okay, so in the Heisenberg picture, it's the operators that evolve in time, and they evolve according to the following equation. So the time derivative of A is just found by taking the commutator with the Hamiltonian. Well, if A is BPS, then this equation simplifies. In particular, we can write it as the commutator of Q of the commutator of Q dagger with A, if A is BPS. And so in particular, because the time variation is Q of something, then it's going to be trivial in cohomology. So for the large part of my talk, I'm going to totally forget about the time dependence here. But I just want to mention one thing. And so the first thing is, I want to give you a finite version of this argument. So here, I'm taking a derivative with respect to time, and I'm arguing that vanishes in cohomology. What I'd like to do is give you a formula for integrating this, essentially, for telling you the difference between two operators inserted at two different points in time, because it involves a construction called descent, which is, I think, a very useful thing. So I want to make a finite version of this argument. Suppose I have some operator A, just like above, and let me be a bit more specific now, and say that it has fermion number J. Then the first thing that I want to do is to construct its descendant. And so this I'm going to define as A1. And I find it by acting with Q dagger. So here you can see that I'm using Q dagger. So there's an additional choice involved. And I'm going to multiply it by D tau. So I should think about this as because I've acted with Q bar, then I reduce the degree by one. Oops. And it's a one form now. Along the time direction. So I can think about my original operator as just depending on time. It's just a function on R. And by descent, what I've done is I've lifted it to a one form, and I've reduced its degree. The important point about this is that this operator has the property that if I take the commutator of Q with A1, then I get D of A. And so in particular, if I integrate this equation, then I get an equation that tells me that the operator at some time t2 minus the operator at some time t1 is given by a Q commutator with the operator that I get by integrating the descendant between those two points. Like this. And so this is a finite version of the argument because I've told you that the operator at two different points is Q commutator of something, and so vanishes in cohomology. The way I've written it, this is the Dolbeau operator on R. Okay, maybe I should have written it like that. Just because I put d tau here, I could. Did I not say Durand? I meant Durand. Of course, yes. Sorry about that. The reason I wanted to mention this is because I think there should be an interesting way to use this to build the higher A infinity products. And this is something that I tried very hard to do, and I was really hoping to explain in this course, but I failed. So I'm just going to leave it as a research question or problem. Maybe I'll put it a bit more nebulously as an idea. So what I'd like to say is that here what I did is I started with a single operator and I performed descent on the real line. What I'd like to do is the same thing for the product of operators inserted at various points. So I could take A1 time tau 1 up to some AN time tau N, where all of these are BPS operators. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to, in a similar way, perform descent to get a series of k-forms on the configuration space of these points. So by configuration space of points, I mean the configuration space here of n ordered points. So just this thing. But actually, I'm not sure if that's the thing that I really want to be working on. It might be better to work on the thing that I get by dividing out by the overall translations of all the operators. So I would divide this by R. Or, I think even better, perhaps, I might want to work instead by further dividing out by both translations and overall scalings on the line. So this would be R times R plus. Where this thing here is overall translations. And this thing is scalings. And then the question is basically, is it possible to build these higher products by integrating one of these descendants over some cycle on this configuration space? And for the degrees to add up, this should be an n minus 2 form. Which is why perhaps I like this this final. I can see that I wrote something that didn't make any sense. So this looks like a good idea to me, but I couldn't get things to work out exactly. So if you're interested in what can be done and where things perhaps go wrong, then you're very welcome to ask me afterwards. Okay, so that's all I want to say about operators, or passing to the cohomology of operators. So now let me do the same for states. Okay, so 2.4 is states. And so here, the story is perhaps even simpler. So the first thing we can say is that because the supercharged Q commutes with the Hamiltonian, then we can decompose our complex into eigenspaces of the Hamiltonian. So let me just keep life simple in doing that, and let me just assume that the spectrum of the Hamiltonian is, say, discrete. So there's some energy levels, there's E0, and then some discrete level E1, and so on and so forth. Then I can decompose the complex. So I could call the bottom level at energy 0 by 0, and then next level by 1. So on and so forth. And then let me look at the cohomology of these complexes now in turn. So the easy one is when the energy is positive and the cohomology vanishes. Why is that true? Well, it happens because all of the states cancel out. So in particular, let's suppose that I have some state psi with energy En. Then what we know from the supersymmetry algebra is that if I act with the commutator of Q and Q dagger on that state, then I should get back En times psi. But if psi is annihilated by Q, then I can invert this relation and write psi as Q of Q dagger acting on the state divided by En. And if En is non-vanishing, I'm allowed to do that. So every state that's Q closed is also Q exact, and the cohomology vanishes there. So the only contributions on passing to cohomology come from the bottom rung of the ladder here. And those coincide with the supersymmetric ground states. So in particular, if I take the cohomology of my complex, claim is that that's actually equal to the kernel of the Hamiltonian. Or the thing that in the last lecture I called curly H. And so I'm not going to give the argument for that because it's a standard argument in Hodge theory. In particular, if I think all you need to use is the orthogonal decomposition together with the inner product that you have. Okay, so let me give just to give a couple of examples, just to go back to the examples we looked at last time. Of course, we're just doing Hodge theory, so I'm going to be telling you things that you know. So an example is the Riemannian model. And in this case, last time we said that the supersymmetric ground states were given by the harmonic forms on X. And of course, what the little argument we made today just tells us this, the thing we know very well, that this is also the Derome cohomology. We have a similar thing for our Hermitian models. where we had a Hermitian manifold X and a Hermitian vector bundle E. And this time, the Hilbert space was given by harmonic forms for the Dolbeau operator on E. And this is also given by the Dolbeau cohomology. Valued in sections of E. Okay, so all we're really doing here is Hodge theory. Now, in the case of operators, we talked about the transfer of structure of the DG structure onto the cohomology, and we ended up, we expected to find an A infinity algebra. Now, we can ask the same thing of states, because we know that states transform the states transformed as a DG module. So when I pass to cohomology, what I should find in this case is an A infinity module. So transfer of structure in this case, the space of Suzy ground states, or the cohomology of Q, should inherit an A infinity module structure. For the algebra of operators. So what does this mean? It means in this case that there are maps now from n copies of O times H back to H. And these maps in this case should have degree 1 minus n. And in this case, because we've passed a cohomology, V0, which would be a differential on H, that vanishes. And V1 is just the thing that you inherit from the standard module action you had upstairs. So again, in principle, there could be higher, non-vanishing, higher order actions here, in principle, which are built by a similar Massey product type. So in order to give some examples of this, I'm going to focus on a particular aspect of supersymmetric quantum mechanics, which I haven't discussed so far, which is the idea of a flavor symmetry. And using flavor symmetry, I'm going to try to give you an example of where, an explicit example of where these higher module actions arise. Okay, so in the second part of my talk, I'm going to switch gears and talk about flavor symmetry. Question? So the first example, I think there will be polynomial differential operators acting on forms. So an example here of a product. So in particular, I could take forms on the target, and they would form a graded commutative cell algebra. And they would act on the states by wedging of forms. And then an example of this kind of structure would be the usual Massey product on forms. That's an example.
But the vertices are not forms.
I mean, I think they could be form value differential operators. Yeah. Tudor, did you want to say something?
Oh, yeah, I mean, the upend is roughly two copies of forms. So it's forms and differential, as you say.
Yes.
Differential operator type.
Yes.
Forms on the diagonal.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, but part of this.
Yes. Right.
So there are massive colors here. There are not only the massive colors on forms, there are massive colors on this linear
form. Yeah, I guess that's the case.
So operators, as been said, so operators are cohomology of X matrix.
Uh-huh.
And as a convolution operator.
Right. Right. Yeah, in any case, I think I'm not going to discuss that example, but I'm going to pass to something coming for flavor symmetry. Okay. Any more questions before I switch gear? Okay. Okay. Okay, so let me talk about flavor symmetry. So there's going to be a group involved, which I'll take to be some compact connected Lie group. And let me try and say what it means for a supersymmetric quantum mechanics to have a flavor symmetry. So first of all, the Hilbert space should be a unitary representation. The group G, and the action should commute with the superchargers. Okay. So in particular for me, I'm going to describe the infinitesimal action in a bit more detail. Okay, so from this point of view, what having a G-flavor symmetry means is that, first of all, there should be some self-adjoint operators that generate this action. So I could write them, say, J sub A. There should be an element of my algebra of operators that have degree zero. So here, A is an index that should run over 1 to the dimension of the group. And they should generate the algebra in the sense that, in the usual sense, if I take the commutator of these operators, I should get something like this. And also, they should commute with the superchargers. So what does this mean? Well, in particular, what it means is that the Lie algebra G is going to act on my complex of states by chain maps, because the action commutes with the differential, or co-chain maps. think another way to say this in this case is that the states should be a DG module. For G. So in practice, I think all that really means is that the individual terms in my complex have to transform as representations of G. So let me give you some examples. Well, let's look at my two examples. So conveniently, I've got them here. So in the case of the Riemannian model, what we can imagine is that X has an isometry. Generated by a real vector field. And in this case, the model will have a U1 flavor symmetry. And the generator, J, will be just given by minus I times the Lie derivative along that vector field acting on forms. In the Hermitian case, I have a similar story. So I again need exactly the same, that X should have an isometry. But that isometry should basically lift to an equivariant action on the bundle that preserves the Hermitian metric. And if those conditions are true, then again, I'll have a U1 flavor symmetry in the theory generated by an operator of the same form. OK, so this is what a flavor symmetry means and how it acts on the states. So what I want to ask is how, when I pass to the cohomology on states, what happens to this flavor action? Can it be non-trivial on cohomology or not? And what kind of structures do I get? OK, so 2.6 is flavor action. On cohomology. So the first thing to say, a very simple thing, is that by definition, we've said that the generator J should commute with Q. And so they'll define a cohomology class. And the question is whether that cohomology class is going to be trivial or not. And so I'm going to distinguish two cases, which are going to be realized in my two examples. And so the two things that can happen, so first of all, it could be that this cohomology class is trivial. So what does that mean? Well, it means that J should be Q of something. Let me call it, say, I. And in that case, then the Hilbert space of supersymmetric ground states is necessarily a trivial module. Why is that true? It's fairly easy to see. Well, if I take J and I act on some state phi, well, I can write that then as the commutator with J, with some J. But if psi is annihilated by Q, then this is the same thing as Q of J acting on psi. Oops, I, thank you very much, yes. Acting on psi, which again is trivial in cohomology. So in this case, passing to cohomology, I don't perhaps get anything interesting. And case two is the other case, where this doesn't happen, where the class is not zero. And in this case, the Hilbert space may be a non-trivial module. So let me again look at my two examples. My two examples are examples of exactly this, these two features. So first, if I look at the Durand model, what we said was that the J was given by minus I times the Lie derivative along the vector field that was generating my isometry. But this is given by minus I times the anticommutator of D with the contraction with the vector field. But D was just my supercharge. So this is just given by Q acting on some with some I. Well, I could take I to be minus I times the contraction operator. So this is exactly an example of case one. And this is indeed the case. Durand cohomology classes will not be charged. Well, they will transform as trivial representations. The Hermitian case is a bit more interesting. So in this case, again, we had the symmetry is being generated by the Lie derivative along a vector field. But in this case, I can only make, because I only have the Dolbeau operator, I can only make the holomorphic, sorry, the anti-holomorphic part of that Q exact. So this piece is Q exact, but I get another piece coming from here. And so this is going to be non-trivial in cohomology, and so this is exactly an example of case two. So let me give you an explicit sub-example of this case. An example of this is Borel-Weibot. So let me maybe I'll move over here. So let me give an explicit example of this Hermitian case. So I could take X to be just CP1. And I can take the bundle E to be some nice holomorphic line bundle, ON. And to keep my life easy, let me take N greater than or equal to 0. OK, so in this case, I have an SU2's worth of isometries just from rotating CP1. So this is going to be my symmetry algebra. And so what's the Hilbert space in this case? Well, we said that it's the Dolbeau cohomology. by Borel Ve Pot. This is the n plus 1 dimensional representation. SU2. So this is exactly an example of this case where passing to cohomology on states, I get a non-trivial representation of the flavor symmetry of my quantum mechanics. On the other hand, in the Durand case, I'm bound to get a trivial action. Durand cohomology classes don't transform under isometries. But in the last part of my talk, what I want to describe is something that you can get in the Durand case. So you can't get an action of the group itself, but it turns out that you can actually get an action of the homology of the group. And that's something I want to explain in the last part. So I think for this, I'm going to take a clean board. So the final section I'm going to call homological G action. And I should say that this is work with Chris Beam, David Ben-Zvi, Andy Knightsky. Sorry, Tudor him off there. But let me say in particular that Tudor is the, I think, maybe the prime mover of this project. Okay, so the claim is that in the case, in the type 1 case that I mentioned, where the flavor generators are Q exact. So in case one, we said that the cohomology on states has to transform as a trivial module under G. But the claim is that it can transform as a non-trivial A infinity module. For the homology of the group. And that's what I'd like to explain in the last part of the lecture. So to keep things very concrete and simple, I'm just going to focus right from the start on the case where G is U1, so I can write things down very explicitly. And the general idea that we'd like to use is to use descent. Now, earlier in the talk, I described about how to descend an operator along the time direction, along R. So starting from an operator that's a function of time, I could find a one form in time, where the degree was one less. This time, we want to do a similar thing, but we want to think about doing this descent procedure on the group itself. So let me try to explain the steps in doing that. So let me start from some state. Let me call it psi. So we could think about this in the Riemannian model as a J form. And it's going to be annihilated by Q. So it defines a cohomology class. So the first thing that I want to do is I want to promote this to something on the group. So I might call it in the following way. And the way we can do that is just by essentially using the exponential map. So let me define psi 0 to be given by the exponential of I theta j acting on my state. So this is something that now depends on an angle, theta. So it's something that lives on u1. In a similar way that when I started evolving my operators in time, I had something that depended on time. Now it depends on a coordinate on the group. And next, I want to do the same thing that I did before, which is to descend this operator. So what I want now is to construct a j minus 1 valued one form on u1. And we're going to build it in exactly the same way we did before. So before we used the fact that the Hamiltonian was the anticommutator of q with q dagger. Now we use a similar idea that the generator, the infinitesimal generator of the group action j is given by q with some I. So in particular, I can define a psi 1 to be given by I acting on psi 0. And then I can multiply that by d theta. And in particular, this will obey the descent equation. On u1. Precisely because of this relation here. Particularly if I act with q, because q annihilates psi 0, I can write that as a commutator of q with I, which gives me back j. OK, so now I have a one form on my group. So there's something that I can try to do, which is to integrate it over a one cycle. And that will get me back to an operator. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. So if we take a one cycle on the group, then we're going to define the action of that on my state by simply integrating this over the one cycle, integrating my descendant operator over the one cycle. And the crucial thing about that is the way that I've set it up. This is how descent works, which is that by defining it in this way, this operator will again be, this state will again be annihilated by q. So let's just check that. If I act with q on this thing, what do I get? Well, if I bring q inside, and I use my descent equation, and I just get d of psi 0 which is also the integral. Using Stokes' theorem, I can write it in this way. And this vanishes. If gamma defines a homology class. So what does it mean? It means that this descends to a map where I've taken an element of H1 of G and used it to define a map from Hj to Hj minus 1. Okay. Takes it to J minus 1 because we had to act somewhere with an I here. Maybe I should say that I has degree minus 1. Because Q has degree 1 and J should have degree 0. Okay, so it may or may not be the case that this action is non-zero, and we should check whether that is or is not the case in a particular example. So I'm just going to give you one example where this is non-trivial, and then there'll be another example to look at in the problems later. So the example I want to do is to go back right back to the first example I think I gave in the lecture, which is a particle on a circle. So I want to work in this Riemannian model, but where I take the target space X to be S1. The symmetry group in this case, the flavor symmetry group is U1, which acts by rotations. So just to give some notation, let me introduce a coordinate on the target space, which is phi. And let me call the coordinate on the group, as I've done previously, by theta. OK, so the first thing we could do is to write down what are the supersymmetric ground states. So in this case, the Durand cohomology of S1. Well, there are just two states coming in degree 0 and degree 1. Which we can think about as complex combinations of 1 and d theta. And so what this means is that there's potential for such an action. So there's a potential for a map of this form. Where I take a homology class of U1 and it maps H1 back to H0. So here the map should have degree minus 1, and so there has a potential for this to exist. We should check whether it really exists or not. So let me do a small calculation to show that it does indeed exist. So let's just follow through this descent procedure. In this particular example. So our starting point, we're going to start with the state, the one form, which is just d phi. This is our element of H1. Perhaps I should say that the vector field here generating the symmetry is given by D d phi. So the first thing I do is promote this to something that's valued on u1 by using the exponential map. So this is, in this case, e to the I theta dot j acting on d phi, or or this thing. Now, if I put a function of phi in front of here, this would be just shifting phi by a constant. But in this case, nothing happens, and I just get back d phi. OK, so the next step is I can compute my first descendant. So how should I do that? Well, I should act with my operator I on phi 0 and then multiply by d theta. But in this case, the operator I was just given by contraction with the vector field. So all that's going to do is to remove the d phi and multiply it by d theta. So I get d theta. And then all I have to do to calculate the action here is to integrate this thing over d theta from 2 pi to 0, which is 2 pi. Maybe I should normalize it by the volume of the group and say that the action is 1. So this is indeed a non-vanishing action of the type that I discussed. OK, so I'm almost finished. I just want to advertise the problem for later on. So here, I only gave you an example where it had a regular module structure. In principle, there could be higher A-infinity module maps. You won't get those in these examples. There's just no room for it for degree reasons. But if you go up in dimension, then you can get such things. So the problem for today looks at the case when X is S3, and again where the flavor symmetry group is U1, which is going to act on S3 by rotating the fibers of the hop vibration. And the problem is going to guide you through how to show that there's a non-trivial A infinity module map. In particular, there's a V2 that takes two copies of gamma, my cycle on U1, and it takes the volume form on S3, let me call it omega, and it maps it back to 1. Okay. So that's all I have to say today. Yep.
Is the existence of this massive product essentially the fact that this action is an equivariantly formal?
Isn't equivariantly formal.
It's not equivariantly
formal. I believe so, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, these are like obstructions to this thing being equivariantly formal. Exactly. It would vanish, yeah. Exactly, yes. That's right. Yeah.
How do you spell NASI? Products. The first word for
products. Did I never write it down? Sorry. I'll write it on the board. I feel like I should have written that word, so sorry if I didn't. Not that I know of, because the question is whether there's a holomorphic analog of what I described here. As far as I know, the answer is no, because the symmetry generator is not Q-exact. And that's really the starting point for this construction. Yeah. I don't think so, but...